Captain James Cook was already one of the greatest explorers in British history before he set off on his third expedition in July of 1776. The writer and historian Hampton Sides has written a narrative history of that voyage, how Cook's disposition as a steady and humane leader began to change, and how it may have led to his death. Cook was in command of two ships with more than 180 people, bound for the Pacific coast of North America in search of a northwest passage to the Atlantic. Along the way, they became the first Europeans to encounter the Hawaiian Islands. They arrived off the coast of Kauai in January of 1778.
It was a true first contact experience. He had no idea these islands were there, and conversely, the people of Kauai had no idea what these ships were about. The oral history that's passed down tells us that some of the Kauaians thought they were manta rays that had come up from the ocean depths.
You write about how some fishermen were out on the ocean when it happened. And you mentioned a man named Mapua.
Right. He's out fishing by torchlight at night when he sees the first ship, the Resolution. He thinks that this is something terrible. And he rushes back to shore and consults with the kahuna, the main priest on the island. And the kahuna says, no, this is something very important. These are temples. These are floating temples. And there's a lot of confusion on shore throughout the night and into the morning as the ships draw nearer that something big is about to happen.
They send some canoes out to investigate. And just the way they see these tricorn hats, they see these uniforms, they see pockets.
They see pockets. And they said, look, they reach into their bodies and they pluck out pieces of treasure. Their bodies are full of treasure. Tricorn hats, you know, they just thought, well, they must have deformed heads with three points. These men also smoked. And these folks from Kauai called them the volcano people because they seemed to always be seething smoke. It is a true first contact experience. Everything good and bad that comes with that. They realized that their world was forever going to change, but they didn't really realize the extent of it. Cook's arrival meant that in subsequent years, many other ships would arrive, and colonialism would take hold of these islands and imperialism, and it would bring disease and alcohol and so many other things that very quickly caused the disintegration of their traditional cultures. So the prophecies turned out to be true.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Hampton Sides' new book is called The Wide, Wide Sea. He's with us for the hour to talk about it. Sides told us he's always loved books about explorers and risk-takers going beyond the boundaries of the world as they knew it. That's how he first came across the stories of Captain Cook.
Captain Cook was very clearly in the pantheon of the greatest explorers of all time, but I didn't really know much about him. I was curious about who was this guy and what further made him interesting to me was that I began to see news reports about him all over the world.
Yeah.
He was becoming controversial. He was becoming kind of part of this larger reckoning that is going on around the world where we're reassessing explorers and rethinking kind of the goals and assumptions of these voyages and how they furthered the larger strategies of imperialism. So I'm like, well, anytime you find a character who's 250 years old but is that controversial, that's interesting.
Yeah.
There's a live wire there. There's something, and perhaps it's a good time to begin to reassess who this guy was and you know why his statues are coming down, why he's become this symbol all over the Pacific of colonialism. So those were some of the reasons. I had read Tony Horwitz's book, Blue Latitudes, many years ago, and was really intrigued by Cook, but also intimidated by him because he did three of these voyages around the world. And even prior to that, he had an amazing career in the Navy. So I didn't want to do a biography you know, cradle to grave biography, because it would just be a 2,000-page anvil, you know, doorstop.
Right.
So I had to say, well, if I'm going to write about Cook, I got to find a different framing device. And it fairly quickly became obvious that as an American writer with an American publisher, I needed to focus on the most American of his journeys, which was his third, where he explores Alaska and the Pacific Northwest, but also along the way stumbles upon Hawaii.
Right.
So this is a story that's about a British captain, but it involves so much of the action takes place in the present day United States. And it happens during the American Revolution, because the ships leave England in July of 1776,
right,
just as the revolution's getting started. So it's a very American tale. And that provided the framing device for me. It's not a biography. It's a book about a single voyage beginning to end.
You mentioned Cook. He wasn't a conqueror per se. He wasn't a colonizer. He was an explorer. He was a map maker, which we'll talk about in a second. But you also don't really let him off the hook in that sense. You say that he was part of that first phase of conquest, that his, you know, voyages did have, you know, work morally complicated. So how did you approach that? You say in the book you're not interested in lionizing him. You don't want to demonize him. You don't want to defend him. So what does that leave? Just sort of putting it out there and saying, this is the story.
Yeah, well, you know, this is the story of whether you like it or not. It's not pretty at times,
yeah.
But I think, you know, most of the people who have written about Captain Cook have tended to be British, sometimes from New Zealand or Australia. And they kind of have very complicated baggage about Captain Cook. He's been perceived in Australia over the years as being a kind of foundational character, a founding father. His statues are all along the waterfront. And, you know, in England, of course, they have lionized him as one of their greatest explorer adventurers. As an American writer, I don't have any of that baggage. I don't really have a dog in a fight. I don't feel like I need to defend him. I just want to explain where he went, what he did, what were the consequences of his actions, and also not just Cook himself, but all his officers, all of his sailors. These were enormous, enormous and very complicated undertakings. Over 180 men on the two ships. They made all these stops all over the place. It's really kind of an ensemble story about, you know, all these different men and how they got along, sometimes how they didn't get along as they went around the world.
Where did James Cook come from? You write that he rose from virtually nothing. He's a farm manager's son, not much in the way of formal education. How does he get to that point where he's a legitimate celebrity in Britain in that time?
Yeah. Well, but certainly one of the things that I do admire about Cook is that he rose up through the merchant marine from very modest circumstances and did so by virtue of his own ferocious competence and hard work and his brilliance with mathematics, trigonometry, astronomy, and map making. This, you know, the Royal Navy at that time, most of the high-ranking officers got there by virtue of, you know, they had money or they had contacts, they had patronage. Cook really had none of that. He had to do it just by hard work and by merit. And he was something of a genius, particularly when it came to map making.
Huh.
He had mapped Newfoundland. He had mapped the entire St. Lawrence Seaway all during the French and Indian War and caught the Admiralty's attention. Like, there's something special about this guy. The quality of his maps, the accuracy of using what we would now consider very crude tools, often having to make these maps at sea, you know, not even being able to come ashore. Extraordinary. So he worked his way up to becoming a captain of a voyage, his first voyage around the world with the Endeavour, HMS Endeavour. And on that ship was a very famous scientist and botanist named Joseph Banks. And this voyage was a huge success. They went around the world. They made first contact with many islands and including the entire east coast of Australia. And after that first voyage, Cook was very much on the map. The Admiralty thought he could do no wrong. Most interestingly, his ships went around the world without a single man developing scurvy,
right,
which was unheard of at that time. Scurvy was this horrible malady, of course, that is caused by a deficiency of vitamin C, but it was kind of considered an occupational hazard of long-distance voyaging, and it was basically tolerated by the navies of Europe as an unfortunate thing. You know, here comes this guy, Captain Cook, who had some kind of regimen on board that involved fresh food and fresh fruit and vegetables that seemed to have conquered scurvy. Of course, he didn't understand that. He knew nothing about vitamin C or anything like that. But, you know, this was one of the things that caught the Admiralty's attention.
So he had reddish brown hair. He was pretty tall, I think 6'3 or something like that. A hawk's nose, a strong chin, deep set eyes. The other thing that you mentioned, he was taciturn, grave and steady. He didn't drink a lot, didn't curse, didn't stray from his wife, had these kind of Quaker values. But when you read his journals, which you did, and when you looked at his logbooks, what did you learn about him as a person? Because it sounds like not much in some ways. He didn't reveal a lot about his emotional life.
He didn't. Now, you know, I think that's typical of captains of those days. They were not emotional people. They didn't reveal a whole lot about their interior lives. And that was also said widely to be an attribute of people from Yorkshire. It still is. They don't talk much. They're very direct. They're very matter of fact and to the point. But it was truly who he was. He was unemotive, if you want to say. And he went to some of the most beautiful, pristine islands in the world and made first contact with many of them, but you would never know it. You know, he doesn't talk about how beautiful they are or how majestic they are. He's interested in all kinds of things like the depth of the water and the quality of the mud at the bottom of the bay, you know, and, you know, the barometric pressure and all kinds of, you know, scientific or semi-scientific, you know, minutiae that you would really expect a captain to be interested in. He's kind of a cyborg. He was kind of a technician, but he was a very, very good one. And, you know, it's kind of remarkable. One of the many things is that on all three of his voyages, his ships came home. Yeah. How many of these voyages ended up with the ships not coming home, everyone dying of scurvy and shipwreck and horrible tales like that? Cook was very methodical in everything he did, including his journals. You realize he's a mathematician. He is something of a scientist. He is a map maker, and the kind of meticulous qualities you have to have to be such a good map maker extends to really the entirety of his personality.
So, as you mentioned, he had these grand voyages, circumnavigated the globe these three times. The book, of course, is about the third voyage. You mentioned the first one. Say a little bit more about the second voyage. The goal of that one was to find this kind of mysterious place. Scientists of the time believed it existed. No one had ever found it. Say something about that one. That was interesting.
Yeah, so a lot of scientists at the time, and not just quacks, but I mean serious scientists, believed that there had to be this giant supercontinent at the bottom of the world somewhere to counteract the preponderance of land masses that existed in the northern hemisphere. Otherwise, the planet, they said, would spin off into outer space. Like, it would be top heavy. It would wobble. And so it had to be there. There was a kind of a fascination with symmetry back then. Like, everything has to be symmetrical. There's got to be the exact land in the south as you would find in the north. Of course, this is crazy. It's just complete cockamamie thinking, but it had gotten on some early maps by Mercator and other map makers. And once you get something on a map, it becomes very difficult to dislodge that concept from the public imagination. And so they wanted Cook to go down there to the Southern Hemisphere, deep, deep, way down there, and explore and find this supercontinent, which was called Terra Australis Incognita. It was supposed to be populated by millions of people, and it was going to be the last unexplored, unknown continent. And he went down there during the first and second voyage, but the second voyage was mainly to look for this thing, and he did not find it. He did become the first European explorer to cross the Antarctic Circle. He almost got to Antarctica, which, of course, is a continent, but nowhere near as big as this giant continent that they were looking for, supposedly bigger than Eurasia. So he comes back to England, and he becomes a hero of what they called negative discovery.
Right.
He did not find the thing that was widely presumed to be there. He was so thorough in his searches in the southern seas that the Admiralty believed him, and they dispensed with the whole crazy notion of the supercontinent. You know, it's weird. It's great when you find something, but it's also equally important sometimes when you find nothing.
Well, I was interested in what you wrote about Cook's own sense of ambition. You know, as you say, he's restrained, he's modest, he's measured. But you write in the book that when Cook was on that second voyage, and he's not far from Antarctica, as you say, he's in that frozen part of the world, you write this, that he had proclaimed his larger aspiration at this moment, that he said he wanted to go, and this is how he put it, as far as he thought it was possible for a man to go. That was so interesting because it does reveal a kind of ambition. He did have a grand sense of his own life, even if he was incredibly modest. He did have a really grand sense of aspiration, I guess, for himself.
Yeah, he was really modest in so many, you know, aspects of daily life, but kind of smoldering within was this incredible ambition. You know, he wanted to be like Magellan or one of the other great explorers in the Pantheon. And he really did want to go as far to the south and as far to the north as anyone had gone. And of course, that line kind of got echoed in the line from Star Trek with Captain James Cook becomes Captain Kirk.
Right.
It is astonishing when he reveals that level of ambition, or perhaps you could call it hubris, and you realize that this modest Yorkshireman has a much larger agenda.
Hampton Sides. His new book is The Wide, Wide Sea, Imperial Ambition, First Contact, and the Fateful Final Voyage of Captain James Cook. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the writer and historian Hampton Sides. We're talking about his new book, The Wide, Wide Sea. It's about Captain James Cook, the great British explorer. Cook was the first European to observe and chart New Zealand and the Great Barrier Reef of Australia, to explore many of the islands of the South Pacific. Sides' new book is about Cook's third expedition, where he set out to find a Northwest Passage in North America and ended up being killed by native Hawaiians. Now, Sides knows that Cook's legacy is contested, and he doesn't try to lionize him or demonize him, just tell the story of his final fatal voyage. Look, say, let's talk about the time between that second voyage and the third one, because for a time it seems like that second one was going to be his last one. He's 46 years old, which is not super old, but you know, he was tired. And he thought that that might be it. The Admiralty gives him this nice, easy job. They make him, you know, captain of this Greenwich Hospital. But then you say the question of when his, as you put it, his terrestrial boredom is going to take hold. That's out there. Like, when does it? So talk a little bit about this period where it seems like he's just going to stay home. And then things change. He doesn't.
So, you know, he'd been around the world twice. He'd done enough. He had really established his legacy. Mm-hmm. Everything was going for him. He had been offered a cushy job, a kind of a semi-retirement where he could be with his wife and children and live at Greenwich and write his books and kind of be a public intellectual. And he does go into retirement. And this is supposed to be the end for him, a kind of a nice rest on his laurels. But then he gets wind of yet another expedition that is being mounted to go around the world to the Pacific Northwest to look for the Northwest Passage, a very, very ambitious expedition. And he starts to get jealous. He starts to get restless. He's like, well, that sounds like something I should be doing. And he's invited to dinner by the very powerful First Lord of the Admiralty, Lord Sandwich. They have decided that they really want Captain Cook to lead this thing too, but they don't want to ask too much of him. So they invite him to dinner and they, you know, probably the wine is flowing and they're having good food there at the Admiralty. And Lord Sandwich clearly is trying to coax him into doing this. And finally, Cook can't stand it anymore. He's so excited to be a part of this expedition that he stands up and raises a toast and says, you know, I'll do it. I'm your man. And I'll go back out one last time. You know, we know now, because we know that this expedition did not go well for him in the end. You know, we can now say that was hubris or reckless or, you know, he was pushing his luck. But there was still more exploring left to do. That, you know, he'd been to the far, far southern seas, and now he had a chance to go to the far northern Pacific and the Arctic Ocean. In a few short months, he's boarding his ship and getting ready to head back out. So these three expeditions, voyages of his, happened in rapid succession.
Mm. You write about how in July, Cook gets, by express mail from London, these, in air quotes here, secret instructions for the voyage, which sort of lays out the goals for the voyage. And one of the goals of the expedition, and it's an entire section of the book. We don't have to spend a lot of time with it. But one of the goals was to transport this Polynesian man named Mai back to Tahiti. Say a little bit about Mai, if you would. He's a really great character in the story.
Yeah. I mean, he's in some ways my favorite character in the story. Yeah. And various times threatened to upstage Cook and all the other officers because of the extraordinary circumstances of his life. He was a young Polynesian man who had come to England on Cook's second voyage, had volunteered to come aboard. He becomes the first Polynesian to set foot on English soil. Mm. He meets very quickly all the intelligentsia. He meets King George. By this point, he's learning English. He also dresses up in fine clothes and learns to hunt at the estates of the aristocracy. He's vaccinated for smallpox. He's a big hit with the ladies. He's paraded around the salons. He meets the gentlemen scientists of the Royal Society. He has a wonderful time in England, and they really do roll out the red carpet for him. Even though they do it, perhaps you could say, in a rather patronizing way, you know, they call him the paragon of the, you know, the noble savage. But they're studying and they're wondering how is this guy going to do in civilized society. By and large, they thought he did tremendously well. But after 2 years of being in England, he's homesick.
Yeah.
He really wants to go back home to Tahiti, and King George says, you know, We owe it to you. You know, of course, we need to get you home. So King George says that Captain Cook will take you home.
Right.
Not only bring you home, but bring you home with all these belongings that you've accumulated during your stay in England. He's got like a a suit of armor. he's got guns. He's got ammunition. He's got all kinds of toys and trinkets and a Bible and
livestock.
And a lot of livestock. Yeah. This is one of King George's sort of pet projects, is that he believes that my, and by extension all the Tahitians, need to have a proper British farm. They need cows and, you know, bulls, and they need horses and sheep and cattle and goats and, you know, peacocks.
Right.
And so Captain Cook's ship, the Resolution, is stuffed with animals, which makes it a very difficult exploratory endeavor when you have all these animals on board giving up a horrible stench and, you know, making all these noises. He's trying to keep them alive as they go through angry seas. The idea is to bring all these animals with Mai and bring them to Tahiti and introduce them to the Tahitian people. So it's kind of a crazy little extra assignment that Captain Cook has to deal with.
The other thing about the book that I want to mention is you really get a sense of what it's like on a ship and how, in some ships anyway, incredibly filthy and kind of disgusting it is. This is something that Cook couldn't really abide. He was a very cleanly cleanliness was very important to Cook. You tell the story early on in the expedition when they're just pounded by rain and the men couldn't get dry. There's mildew sets in. Cook calls for the ship to be smoked was the thing that they do. Maybe you could talk about that moment, because it just gave you a sense of how miserable an experience this could be at times.
Yes. Well, of course, these ships are very dank and dirty and wet all the time, and there's mildew and mold and cockroaches and rats and all kinds of other little weevils and vermin of all sorts. And although Captain Cook is a germaphobe, I guess you'd say, and someone who seems to have a kind of almost an innate sense of germ theory before that was even an accepted theory. He's constantly at war with grime and dirt and moisture. There's no way to control it. You know, it's just there. It's an ever-present part of the experience of being on these long voyages. You would not really want to be on one of these ships, you know, twisting in your hammock in violent storms. And, you know, it's such a miserable kind of confined experience for these men. They're constantly smoking the ship, as they put it, mainly to kill rats and to kill cockroaches. And they also kind of had this theory that it also killed the causes of other diseases. But their understanding of how to do all this was somewhat rudimentary. You know, they didn't really understand the idea of germs. So it's an uphill battle the whole way, for sure.
You write about this ritual or ceremony called ducking. It's when the Resolution passes over the equator and Cook gathers all the crew together for this ritual. It was a nice little detail. Maybe you could just sort of mention it, because I think the really great part of it is there's someone who doesn't really like it, and he's another great character, William Bly.
Yes. Yeah, when you cross the equator, there's an old tradition that you were supposed to be ducked or dunked into the sea, kind of a baptism, which is scary because they have hold of you, and you're not supposed to be able to tumble out into the open sea. Most sailors did not know how to swim. It's unbelievable that the Royal Navy did not require people to know how to swim. So it was a rather dangerous ritual, kind of a hazing ritual. And anyone who has not already crossed the equator in perhaps a previous voyage had to go through this ritual or give up their grog. So most of the men said, no, I will not give up my grog, so let's do it. And William Bly, who is a young officer who will later become quite infamous for the mutiny on the Bounty, he's a young officer studying under Cook, serving under Cook, and he takes a dim view of this whole ritual. It's like, it's silly. It's absurd. Why are we doing this? It could be dangerous. It's, you know, William Bligh was a really capable seaman, but also someone who just basically took a dim view of any sort of fun or silliness. And, you know, he said, this is absolutely absurd. I can't believe they're doing this.
Well, it's right around this time that you mentioned, even though Cook, of course, he delights in the ritual, but something is going on with James Cook. And he's restless. He starts to become preoccupied. Something is changing. You say that he became erratic, and then he used to be quite restrained, but then he becomes quite tyrannical. Will you talk about what it is that's starting to shift, as far as we know anyway, with James Cook?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that all of Cook's biographers and even some forensic medical kind of buffs have speculated. What was it? Because there was definitely a pronounced change in his personality. He was famous during his first two voyages for his leniency, for his tolerance, for his generally refusing to use the lash on his own men, and for just being generally humane toward the indigenous people that he encountered. On the third voyage, we see this despot. We see this guy that has a huge temper. You can never predict when it's going to flare up. He's brooding. He's alone in his cabin much of the time. Something is up with him. He's depressed. And then he's violently and explosively angry. So the leading theory is that he must have, and this was certainly not uncommon at the time for long-distance voyagers, that he must have eaten something that led to a parasite in his gut that was preventing the absorption of critical vitamins, vitamin B especially, that can cause some very severe changes in mood and personality. That seems to be the kind of widely accepted theory, but I don't know. There's other things going on. I mean, clearly these voyages are hard on the human body, and they are also hard on your psyche. And he's now on his third voyage, and he's an older man. Something is wrong with them. And, other theories are that he had a bipolar disorder, which we might diagnose today. He was also in excruciating pain. He has something called sciatica, which is a pinched nerve, a sciatic nerve, that was causing a lot of pain, and the pain was affecting him. So you add all this up and you have a captain who's just been through a lot, who is now on his third voyage, and he's just a very different man.
I'm going to skip forward a little bit on the story here and ask about when he realizes, or thinks anyway, on his first attempt, gosh, we can't find this Northwest Passage. One may not exist. And it's a really good section in the book I'll just recommend for people, because you write about how Cook had to think long and hard about the mechanics of ice formation. This is when his gifts as a navigator really on display, his skills working his way through this, pack ice and shifting ice. But he's beginning to wonder about how ice works, those kinds of things. But they can't find this Northwest Passage, as you write. And so they have to leave, at least for the season. And he wants to stay in the Pacific through the winter. He wants to return to Alaska. He says, we'll come back to this Alaska area in the spring. But then they had to figure out where to spend the winter. And this gets us to the sort of critical part of the story, returning to the South Pacific. Talk a little bit about that sort of crucial decision, deciding to go back.
Right. Well, it's a little bit like what he did when after two voyages around the world, he made the decision to go back out one more time. So he looked for the Northwest Passage. It was very clear that there was ice, an impenetrable wall of ice up there. He nearly got trapped in the ice and would have been crushed by it. most commanders at that point would have said, you know what, it's not there. Or if it's there, it's just too risky. It's crazy. These ships weren't even reinforced for the ice. Most commanders would have said, let's just go home. We've done enough for the Admiralty. We've fulfilled our mission. Captain Cook said, no, you know what? We're going to come back next summer and do it one more time, maybe from a slightly different angle at a slightly different time of the season. Maybe we'll find our way through. So he's pushing his luck once again. But then he says, you know, well, we got to go somewhere for the winter and thaw out. We can't spend it up here. Why don't we go back to that amazing archipelago that we stumbled upon earlier in the voyage, Kauai and Hawaii, the archipelago that he knew immediately when he came to Kauai that this was an extraordinary find that the Admiralty is going to want to know more about. Why don't we just go back there and spend the winter down there? They've got friendly people. They've got beautiful women. They've got lots of pigs and lots of food and good timber to repair the ship. Why don't we go back there? And of course, it's not exactly close. Is it like 3,000-5,000 miles, I guess, down to Hawaii? But that's where he decides to go. And of course, Hawaii is where kind of the last act of his career takes place. And it's probably the part of his life that is best known, certainly in Americans, which is the series of events that kind of funnel almost like a Greek tragedy down to his demise on the big island of Hawaii.
Hampton Sides, his new book is The Wide, Wide Sea. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners just like you. To donate, visit KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to a conversation with Hampton Sides. We're talking about his new book, The Wide, Wide Sea. I wanted to ask you about, there's this extraordinary scene. We were talking about the story you tell about arriving in Kauai. But there's another really dramatic moment, a story of arrival in January of 1779, where these ships arrive in this bay called the Pathway of the Gods. It's this place of royal authority on Hawaii for, you know, years and years and years. But the scene there, the scene of kind of adulation and joy among the Hawaiian people is kind of remarkable. Tell us what happens when the Resolution and the Discovery enter this harbor.
Yeah, so when Cook's ships arrive at Kealakeakua Bay on the Kona coast of the Big Island, they just so happen to arrive at the height of a festival called the Makahiki, which celebrates the god Lono, the god of fertility, at the very place where the great temple dedicated to Lono is located. And there was a prophecy that said that Lono would someday in the future return to this very place in large ships that have huge sails, very much shaped like Cook's vessels. And it is just a remarkable kind of bit of serendipity, or perhaps you could say bad luck in the end, that he arrived at this very place, at this very time, at the very height of this kind of revelry, when passions were running high, kind of a rapturous, wonderful time of year. His ships come into harbor, and he's gotten many warm greetings over the years and during his voyages, but nothing like this. This is something different. They are calling him Lono. They're prostrating themselves, bowing down to him. They bring him into the temple where he becomes the central figure in this very elaborate religious ritual they really do seem to think he is the god Lono, and if not the god, then some sort of kind of manifestation or some sort of a, you know, like a, some almost like a character in a religious passion play. So that's how Cook arrives in this place. They do seem to, you know, anthropologists have argued for a long time about, you know, did all the Hawaiians really think this, or was it just the priests, or, you know, there's to be a lot of debate among the scholars, but clearly for a while there, they thought he was a supernatural being of some sort, and the priests were certainly encouraging the people to think that way. But, you know, I think it's kind of indicative of you know, when a person becomes deified, things usually do not go well for them. And very quickly, once they decide some number of weeks later that Cook definitely was not the god Lono, things unravel very quickly. And the Hawaiian people have a very different opinion of him and his men. They think he's overstayed his welcome, and things escalate. There's a series of miscues and miscommunications that lead to his very, very, you know, violent death on the lava flats there at the bay. And that's sort of the subject of the last 50, 60, 70 pages of the book, is kind of like, how did this most disciplined explorer, who quite justifiably, I think, felt that he was sympathetic and, you know, appreciated the Polynesian culture, how did this guy end up dead on the lava flats? What series of things led to this tragic fate?
This may be one of the parts that you don't want to reveal, but I'll ask it, and you can just say, I don't want to talk about that. But one of the things that's really interesting to me in the story, and we won't give too much away about what happens, it's the really that last quarter of the book, which is just really gripping. But you do see at the end, as Cook is surrounded by this, as you say, this roaring throng, he becomes strangely calm. Doesn't want to lose face, didn't want to appear undignified. He figures he misreads the situation for sure. But after all this time, he thinks, he understands their body language and emotion, but he gets it wrong. But he's just strangely calm. I don't know if you want to talk about that, but I thought it was such a remarkable image.
Yeah, it is something about Captain Cook. I don't know if he was, you know, he's just sort of the classic British, you know, stiff upper lip. And, you know, you don't want to turn around and run. You have to show composure. But he was misreading their anger. He clearly thought that if I hold my gun in a certain way and show them, you know, my sort of concerted, you know, defiance, they, you know, they certainly won't attack me. He also had another factor at play here, which people don't think about very often, but he could have turned around and just jumped in the water.
Yeah.
But for the fact that Captain Cook, just like almost all other naval officers at the time, could not swim. You know, he probably was scared he'd drown in there. So he stands his ground, and I think he thinks everything will go well, because so many times in so many islands and so many first contact experiences that he'd had elsewhere in Polynesia led him to think, well, you know, it's going to be fine. He was certainly pushing his luck, but he maybe didn't think it was luck. Maybe he just thought he has some kind of special way of dealing with Polynesian people. It had gone so well for him up till then. And I think when you think about Captain Cook's death and how shocking it was, you might also look at it in a different way, which is it's kind of shocking that it hadn't already happened.
Yeah.
In all those encounters with all those people, and, you know, people that didn't know who he was, what his intentions were, it's amazing that he hadn't already been killed.
How do you describe, Hampton Sides, the consequences of what happened to James Cook? Like the immediate consequences you write about, a day or so later, while trying to get water for the ship, some of the Englishmen go on this rampage. You write about that. the Hawaiians, seeing the power of, you know, muskets and cannon and this kind of technology, they have to sue for peace. And so there's that immediate part. But like, how are you thinking about those immediate and even the longer term consequences of what happened that day?
Well, I mean, I think it was a kind of a shocking event that had ripple effects in so many different ways. That, you know, back in England, when they finally learned about it, there was an immediate call for, like, we need to send out another voyage, you know, to exact retribution on these islanders for their, you know, attacking their great captain. We've been talking earlier about how maybe the Hawaiians thought he was the god, Lono. Mm. Well, the British seemed to almost deify Cook as a martyr of exploration. Of like, you know, there's a famous engraving that shows him going off to heaven from Kealakekua. You know, like, he's the great British explorer who has now entered the pantheon of, you know, all the great exploring gods. It's something that has entered the kind of the iconography of exploration. You know, very famously, Magellan, the great Portuguese explorer, was hacked to pieces on the beach in the Philippines. And Captain Cook, who often wrote about Magellan, was fascinated by Magellan, you know, had really tried his whole life to avoid that fate. And yet it happened to him. Somehow got himself enmeshed in the passions of the local people and ended up hacked to pieces on a different beach in the Pacific. So it's an event that kind of has shockwaves in all kinds of ways. You can go down to the site of Cook's death at the bay, where there's a plaque marking the exact spot and where there is a large obelisk that talks about Cook, and an obelisk that is a kind of a controversial place where the native Hawaiians have constantly, you know, splattered it with red paint and vandalized the site. It's a nerve center for this larger debate that goes on around the world about colonialism and, you know, should these explorers ever have come and why don't they leave? Will they ever leave?
Yeah.
There are bigger questions that are, you know, obviously being debated around the world, and particularly there on the big island of Hawaii.
Final question. I wanted to ask you about the epilogue you wrote for the book, where you mention the festival that comes along with the seasonal rains. Why did you want to end there? Why did you want that as a coda for the story?
You know, I start the book out with this kind of mythic language that really conjures up first contact and relies a lot on oral history. And I wanted to kind of end it in the same way, with the same tone and kind of the same register. And I guess I was also kind of getting at some of the similarities, at least superficial ones, between Captain Cook and Lono. Okay, so at some point or another, the Hawaiians did seem to think that Captain Cook may have been Lono. Okay, so, you know, Lono was this god who was beloved by his people, but he accidentally killed his wife in a fit of rage and atoned for his sins by creating this festival to honor the coming of the rains and the, you know, the harvest and renewal. But he felt so guilty about it all that he decided to leave his people. He built this enormous ship and disappeared off the edge of the world. But before he did, he said, one day I will return to Hawaii, to this very place, and it will happen, you know, someday in the distant future. And that's how this Makahiki festival that Cook arrives during, how it got its start. So I decided to end the book kind of tonally with some of the same mythic language and to look at kind of some of the at least superficial ways in which Lono and Cook really were similar, and that their legacies, very complicated legacies, are intertwined.
Hampton Sides, thank you very much.
It's been a real pleasure being with you.
Hampton Sides. His book is The Wide, Wide Sea, Imperial Ambition, First Contact, and the Fateful Final Voyage of Captain James Cook. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And we're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. You can email us with suggestions or comments at radiowest@kuer.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.